Then, what I actually wanted to talk about before I got distracted to all of that, I wanted to talk about the different classifications of the vows, so that you learned a little bit about how early Sangha life was, okay? And like I mentioned yesterday, you know that when they talk about Upali reciting the Vinaya at the first council right after the Buddha's parinirvana, you know, you get the idea that he just said, okay, there's so many of this and so many of that and so many of this, and exactly the pratimoksha and Vinaya that we have now. But actually, you can see even in the Vinaya, I mean, they tell the story of the first council, they tell the story of the second council. So part of the Vinaya was definitely written even after the time of the Buddha. These different precepts that are now codified in the Pratimoksha, you know, exactly what Upali recited, you know, I wonder. Why I wonder that? Because, you know, they say that, one of the big hesitations that the Sangha communities have now is changing any of the Pratimoksha precepts. And the reason they give for that is that when Buddha said to Ananda, you know, that the major vows major precepts should not be altered, but the secondary ones could be altered, Ananda forgot to ask the Buddha which are major ones and which are secondary ones. Okay, so therefore they say we can't alter anything. On the other hand, when they go through the Pratimoksha, the precepts are divided in the Bhikshu and Bhikshuni precepts into very distinct categories. And you get a very clear thing of which ones are most important and which ones aren't. Okay? So I wonder if it was already set up exactly like it is, outlined and put into these different categories, then why did even Mahakasapa at the first council say we can't change anything because we don't know what's major and what's minor? Just a question I have, okay? And I'm not saying I know anything. It's just something I wonder about, okay? But anyway, now we have, all the different pratimokshas according to the different systems, and now, you know, they're standardized. So exactly when they were standardized, I don't know, you know. And it's quite interesting, just the development of these different pratimokshas and different vinayas, because that's a whole other topic about the schisms. Let me do this first, okay? And then we'll do that one. Otherwise, I'll do that one, not do this one, okay? Okay, so let's look right now at life in the Sangha, okay? And so these are how the major categories of vows are set up. And like I say, I'm not saying that this is how they were defined in these specific categories, you know, necessarily at the Buddha's time, because like we know, the Buddha just made up precepts here and there as a situation arose. And so I would imagine categorizing them into different categories, that would have come much later. Yeah? Okay, so the first category are called the ones that are defeats or parajika. Okay? So, and here we're talking about the full ordination, the bhikshu and bhikshunis, because the bhikshu and bhikshunis are the actual sangha. The shramanera and shramanerikas are novices. The reason that one would become a novice is either, number one, you were under 20 years old, but you were old enough to scare a crow. You had to be old enough to scare a crow in order to take the novice vows. And the novice vows were set up because, you know, initially there weren't any, and then you had these young children who were ordaining, and they would wake up in the middle of the night crying, you know, for this and that, and, because they were hungry and or because of one thing or the other. So then the Buddha said, okay, well, the young people, should not take the full ordination. You have to be 20 years or older to take it. Okay? So then you have the Shramanera, and Shramanerikas develop for the people under 20 years old so that they can have that experience of living an ordained life. Okay, so those are the novices. And then, so that was one purpose of having novices. The second purpose was that the novices have fewer actual precepts. So it's easier to keep, and the purpose of being a novice is in order to train to take the full ordination. So the novice ordination is not an end to itself. You take it as a stepping stone to become a fully ordained. Because it's the fully ordained that are the actual members of the Sangha. Okay? So whenever you have Sangha karma or Sangha decisions, it's only made by those who are fully ordained, not the novices. Okay? The novices may come and give their opinions or share ideas, but they don't have voting power in the Sangha, functions like that. Okay? So, what I'm describing is applying to the fully ordained. One thing as a Shramanera, a Shramanerika, is even though you don't have the full vows, you try and live as though you did. So it's a period whereby you can try on the full precepts, not vows, but precepts, trainings, without having to bear, you don't get necessarily reprimanded or have to go through these different confession processes because you don't actually have the precepts. But it's a time you should try and live by them even though you don't have them. Okay. Anyway, so you have the defeats, okay, or the parajikas. And for the monks, in all the different pratimokshas, the monks have 4, the nuns have 8. Okay. And we can go into all of that later if you want to. But if you break any of the 4, for the monks, it's sexual intercourse, killing a human being, stealing something of value, such that the legal system and the society would get involved, and lying about your spiritual attainments. Okay, so those 4 are the 4 root ones for the nun, for the monks. For the nuns, in addition, you add on to being involved in petting and foreplay, or there's 2 kind of vows, or making plans to like meet a man and do something, and then a 3rd one is following a bhikshu who has been suspended or expelled from the Sangha, and then the 4th is if you know that another bhikshuni has committed a parajika, and you conceal it from the community, you don't tell them, then you yourself commit one. Okay? So the nuns have these four extra ones. But in the case of all of these parajikas, if you do them and all the branches are complete, then it says you are expelled from the order, but actually you're not expelled. You have yourself opted out of the order. Okay? Why? Because these are the common ways in which people live together, and now you have chosen not to follow those common ways. Okay? So, I think this is a very interesting way to see it. It's not like there's a law and you broke a law. It's you yourself have distanced yourself from the community. The community doesn't kick you out. You, by your behavior, have distanced yourself. Okay? So, so if the 4 defeats are there, finito. Okay? And you never get another chance to ordain. If you've broken one of your root vows, there's never any chance to reordain. Okay, then you have the next class of vows are the Sangha Vishesa, And that's translated sometimes as remainders or as suspensions. They're called remainders because they are close to parajika, to the defeats. Okay, and they're called, the parajika are called defeats because you're defeated. Your monastic vocation is defeated. These are called remainders because they're close there, but you still have something left of your ordination. You haven't broken a root vow. So there's a remainder of your ordination there. Okay. So that's why they're called remainders. Sometimes they're called suspensions because the result of having committed one of these is that you are temporarily suspended from the Sangha. Okay? Suspension from the Sangha doesn't mean that you go live away from the Sangha. Actually, it means you stay in the Sangha because you especially need the support of the Sangha at that time. Okay? You may sometimes stay alone for a few days to kind of think about what you've done, but you still live within the Sangha, so you get that support to really get yourself back on track. But, for example, you know, usually the Sangha sits in order of ordination. If you've been suspended, you no longer do this. You go to the end of the line. So that you're the last one served. You do not receive respect from those junior to you, but instead you become junior to all the other fully ordained ones and offer them respect and offer service to them. If you're suspended, you can't take part in an ordination ceremony. You can't take part in various other Sangha functions. Okay? So you're suspended for a period of time. And like I was saying today, if you concealed your fault, then the number of days you concealed it is added on to the week of your suspension. Okay. And then to be reinstituted, okay, after your period of penance is over, to be reinstituted, for the monks, you need a gathering of 20 monks to come together and perform the ceremony, which rehabilitates you, and you again come back in and sit in your regular place and receive your regular privileges. For the nuns, you need 20 monks and 20 nuns to come together to do it. So the thing about the Sangha Vasesa is that they become a real hassle. Okay, if you do them, they're a real hassle. So there's you really don't want to do them because, first of all, everybody then knows that you've broken something really big. And second of all, everybody's really inconvenienced because so many people have to come together and rehabilitate you. Okay, so there's a lot of peer pressure, you know, or should I say, a positive use of our attachment to reputation here, of not wanting to transgress these certain ones. What I find very interesting is in Thailand now, they still will keep this. And if some of the monks have done any of these actions, they will go and confess it and, you know, be you know, on suspension for a while and then be rehabilitated. I've also heard of certain situations in Thailand where maybe they'll have like kind of a big time where everybody who's during the year done one of these things, they all kind of do manatta together and then they're all rehabilitated together. Okay? But in the Theravada system, you receive the retribution for this. In the Chinese system, when I was asking Venerable Wu Yin about it, we asked it, do you still do this and perform these ceremonies? And she said, well, we take really good care so that you don't have to get to the point of anybody doing this. Okay? The Tibetans, I've never heard of this ceremony being done in the Tibetan community. You know, I've never heard of them doing it. Why? I haven't asked. They'll probably say nobody does it. I'm not sure if I completely accept that or not. Okay? But it's just interesting how things are done in the different Buddhist traditions. I don't know in the Vietnamese tradition if they do the ceremonies or not.
And monastic rites get protection. Said that the reason they don't do it is because it's too embarrassing for people to really confess what they did, so they just do sojong every 2 weeks and cover all the bases. Like,
yeah.
He actually said, like, that's why it was dropped.
Yeah. Well, it is very embarrassing.
Yeah.
These 13 for the monks and the nuns are different, okay? The first one for the monks is intentional ejaculation. So there, you know, there goes masturbation. So, you know, that's a really kind of embarrassing thing if you keep on having to go to all your fellow monks and say, you know, I'm masturbating, you know, yet again, and next month again. You know, it's like, okay. So, but you can also see how this one is a really important one to avoid, because if you start with masturbation, then it very easily spills out to having an extra a partner, and then your ordination is defeated. Okay? What's interesting is the one about masturbation for women. It's one of the pious atikas, so it's a simple lapse, and it's just something that is confessed to another nun. Don't ask me why. Usually things are more strict for nuns. This is one where it isn't. But I think women don't have the difference in bodies. You know, I don't think women have the same difficulty with their sexual energy as men seem to have. But I'm just making a big generalization. Even though, you know, according to Vinaya and Tibetan culture, they think women are just like panting all the time and, you know, ready to jump in bed with anybody who walks by. But, you know, I don't know about you, but that's not how I was raised, and that's not what I observe, you know? But anyway. Okay, so some of the ones, here are the ones for the men. Okay, so you have intentional ejaculation, touching a woman, speaking suggestively to her, you know? So, here's a good one. Urging a woman to earn merit by yielding to a religious man. How often have we heard this one, you know? You know, and this happens nowadays. I mean, these are all these scandals, you know. You sleep with me, you get some special power. Sure. Okay, serving as a go-between. This one is actually in common between the monks and the nuns. So you're not allowed to be a matchmaker and carry messages from men and women, you know, or any two people who are sexually interested in each other. Okay, so that's why, in general, Buddhist sangha we do not perform marriage ceremonies. We can do a marriage blessing. So people may have a secular ceremony and come to the temple and make offerings, and you have some blessing and, you know, some ritual because they create merit, and so you pray for their well-being, but the Sangha does not perform the ceremony. Okay, and then you don't carry messages between people. The reason for this is, as Venerable Wu Yin said when she was teaching it, she said, you know, how many marriages do you know that are really good ones? Yeah? Not many. Well, if you've acted as a go-between to get two people together and it's not a good marriage, who do they blame? You know? So this is to avoid Sangha getting blamed for other people's marital problems. And I think it's also to protect the mind of the Sangha so that you're not involved with, you know, he's falling in love with her and this one and that one and how are they doing? And, you know, you do a marriage ceremony and they're all sitting there like this, looking at each other, and then your own attachment comes up. So it just frees you from having to get involved in all of that. Okay. Okay, another one that's in common is falsely accusing another fully ordained person of committing a defeat. Okay, so there's a lot here in terms of, you know, you don't want to be mad at somebody and then say, oh, but, you know, they actually slept with somebody or they killed somebody or whatever. Okay, so falsely accusing somebody of having broken their root vows, then that's a big one. You get suspended because of that. Or insinuating that somebody broke one of their group vows when they didn't. Okay? So you don't actually directly falsely accuse them, but you just kind of say, well, mama, and give somebody lead somebody to believe that somebody did break a root vow when in fact they didn't. Okay, so that's one of these remainders. Fomenting discord in the Sangha. Okay, so trying to divide the Sangha into different factions where there's four or more people in each faction, or going along with somebody who's the schism maker. Okay, so really fomenting disharmony and saying, oh, this one, look what he's doing, and he has wrong views and he's doing things the wrong way. We're going to do it the right way. Come over here and be with me and my side. And it just causes turmoil in a Sangha community.